This is an April Fool's edition of On Your Money, with tips to keep us safe from financial scams and theft and fraud and unwise investments. I'm Joy Cardine, inviting you to join in with your financial questions and concerns for financial planner Kevin McKinley, who might be a jokester from time to time, but doesn't fool around with his financial advice. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, and he joins us from our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Eau Claire. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
You jokester, you. Hey, did you hear that we're moving On Your Money to 6 a.m. on Tuesdays starting next week?
And we're going to do it live, I would assume?
Yeah.
Good to know. You joke about that, but stranger decisions have been made in the past.
And so that's not happening. Just for any listener who just heard that, a bunch of calls are going into listener services right now. That is not going to happen.
Yeah, the calls are coming and going, hey, I normally listen to Wisconsin Public Radio at 6 a.m., and I don't care to listen to that show.
In any case, this is a special April Fool's Day, or I should say April Fool's Week edition of On Your Money, and we are going to share some tips on how to avoid being a financial fool. What do you want to start with, Kevin?
Well, I'd like to start with the original personal finance pundit, Benjamin Franklin, said, "A fool and his money are soon parted." Mm-hmm. So we are going to start with preventing fraud, theft, and other problems, being fooled on the phone and on the web, protecting your identity, and a big topic right now, tax income preparation-related fraud.
Oh, I need to know that. I'm going to mine soon. Let's start with the web.
Well, a lot of the emails that people get, especially if they get through the spam filter, appear to come from big organizations like Microsoft or eBay or banks or the IRS. And these organizations generally do not contact you via email. So if you get one of these, do not respond to the email. Don't click on the links in the email. And definitely do not open the attachments that are on top of any of these emails whatsoever. Typically what happens is many of these appear to be serious, and so they try to scare you into responding or opening the attachment, and then there's a virus within the attachment that infects your computer, allows them to either use the computer's processor or, more dangerously, allows them to get access to your personal information inside of there. So if you do get one of these emails and it looks legitimate, again, don't respond, but contact the organization yourself by going directly to the website, typing it in the web browser yourself. Don't click on anything in the link whatsoever.
Yeah. What I'm seeing a lot these days is all sorts of retailers, and it's sort of this, it's almost like a form letter, and store X, click here to get your rewards,
right.
Coffee shop this, click this to get your rewards, and they really don't want to reward me, do they?
No, well, some of them do, but again, you can kind of tell, and if you have any suspicions, sometimes an easy way to look is to take your cursor, and don't click on it, but hover over some of the links that they want you to click on, and if you look down on the lower left-hand side of the browser, sometimes you'll see the actual address, and you'll see it's a jumbled mixture of numbers. It's a name that's not spelled correctly. Microsoft is spelled with an N to start it or something. It's Microsoft. So, yeah, just keep an eye on that, and definitely don't click on it. Contact the organization directly.
And what about if we get these things by phone?
This is where we see a lot of people have caller ID, and they see it's coming from the IRS or it's coming from Microsoft. It's another scam that the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection in Wisconsin released a notice about a little while ago, where Microsoft was calling people allegedly and saying, "You have, I want you to go to your computer and start doing all these different things with it." Well, sometimes it'll be the IRS where they'll say or purport to say that they have a need for your credit card number, your Social Security numbers, and they have a big check for you, or a refund check, or they go the other direction. They go bad cop, and they say, "We are going to suspend your driver's license, or we're going to impose a fine, or send you to jail." And that can scare some people into giving out that information that they otherwise wouldn't normally want to do. So don't give out any information. If you suspect anything suspicious about the call, hang up. And again, these people will generally not contact you by the phone. The IRS will contact you via mail with a very official-looking envelope. But if you have any questions about it, hang up, contact the organization directly and say, "Hey, is there a problem here or an issue I should know about? I just got this call."
So are there other things we should do to prevent theft or fraud or financial scams?
Absolutely. You want to build your defense now before the attack happens. You can freeze your credit report. It costs $10 per bureau to freeze your credit report, and $10 if you need to open it up again, and $10 if you need to freeze it. But most people will hardly ever need to do that, if ever at all. Go to tinyurl.com/cfreeze, tinyurl.com/cfreeze, and we'll have the links up to our website at onyourmoney.com for all of these. You can also go to annualcreditreport.com to see your raw credit data. Again, that's once per bureau per year, so there's three bureaus, so you can check it three times the year for free. You definitely want to download some virus protection, so if you do accidentally click on a nefarious website or open up a bad file, this will hopefully protect your computer. Avast and Malwarebytes are two of the best free ones. And finally, if you do have a PC that you're concerned about, especially if it's a Windows-based PC, you might want to update the operating system and download any of the latest critical updates that they have supplied for you.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or the services that we discuss are suitable for any or every investor. Investors should consult with their own financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. That being said, if you have a question for Kevin, you can call us now. We have an open line at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Time now for the On Your Money email bag, and we have a listener who is concerned about getting fooled on a long-term insurance policy. Ed says, "Dear Kevin, enjoy your shows and appreciate your advice. I listen every week. Would you please share your views about long-term care insurance, please? We are looking at an offer, and while the benefits look adequate, the premiums are really expensive from our point of view. Is there some guidance about the upper limit or what percent of your income should be spent on this kind of insurance? Are there some provisions in these policies that should be avoided? Are there features of this kind of insurance that companies would not like you to recognize right away? Your help, as always, would be welcome." So, Kevin, what do you have to say for Ed?
I'm sorry, I wasn't listening. Could you start over with that one, please?
Long one, but it was full of
very good. Lots of information and a lot of questions that a lot of our listeners have right now. Let's start with the philosophy of long-term care insurance. Most people buy this so they can get in now while they are relatively healthy and don't necessarily need the insurance. And then down the road, if they should need it, they can use it to help pay for long-term care expenses. The problem is there is no guarantee out there that you will need this type of care, or that you can continually afford to pay for the policy, or even that the insurance company will be around and willing to pay. Many long-term care insurance companies are realizing that they mispriced these policies way back when, and they didn't charge enough for it. And more people have kept the insurance than what they thought, and more people are living longer and costing more for the claims on the policy. And many, many companies now are dropping this coverage, and there are very few new ones entering into the market. So instead, if you are going to get this coverage, look at it as a 30-day term long-term care insurance policy. If every 30 days when the premium is due, and most charge premiums monthly, if you need the insurance and you can afford the premium for the month and you want it, go ahead and make that check payment. But if you can't for whatever reason, know that you can cancel it at any time, but also know that there is a chance that that you may pay for this for 20 years and you may die in your sleep in your own bed and you may never need it, or the company just might not be able to afford to pay for it in the way that they originally hoped and promised that they would.
So what are the financial parameters of paying for the insurance?
Generally, if you have a net worth of more than $200,000 and less than $2 million, it's something to consider. If you have less of a net worth than that, you probably can't afford the premiums. And if you have more than that, it's probably better to just self-insure, meaning paying for any care out of your savings and investments. Now, a lot of people who listen have pension payments, where they maybe don't have a net worth that high, but they do have a high income coming in. For those people, I'd say if the premium is going to take up, say, more than 5% of your monthly income, then it's probably something that you should avoid. Anything less than that might be okay and it might be affordable, but if it's more than 5% of your monthly income, it's probably too expensive for you.
And what are the provisions in a long-term care policy that you think buyers should have and ones they should avoid?
I'd like to see a high deductible, meaning that there's a lot of care that you have to pay for before it kicks in. And the reason being is that's generally going to be a less expensive policy. And in turn for getting a break on the premiums because you're willing to pay more initially, get more coverage over the longer term, especially if you're concerned about dementia or Alzheimer's care down the road. You also might want to look at partnership policies, where the state of Wisconsin is one of many states that offers partnership policies, meaning if people buy this qualified long-term care insurance policy, they actually get to keep the amount of their own assets that's equal to what the long-term care policy pays before qualifying for public assistance. And so it allows you to preserve some of your assets and still qualify for public assistance down the road.
What are your thoughts of those who divest or purposefully try to impoverish themselves to qualify for public assistance?
That can be very foolish. There are several preventions and measures in place to kind of protect the system from people gaming it by saying, oh, gosh, I've got a bunch of money, but I don't really wish to spend it on long-term care for whatever reason. I'm going to give it all away to my family right now and then go into the nursing home and get public assistance. First of all, if you do try to do that, you have to give it away usually at least 5 years in advance of trying to qualify for public assistance. And you may not actually need that care at some point down the road, and in which case you might regret giving your money away, or you may actually need the care, but the amount of public assistance that either you need or that you're expecting may not be there, and the money that you gave away may not be there either because you gave it away.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC. He is with us every week at this time, and he'll stay at this time, answering your personal finance questions. 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We'll get to your questions in just a moment. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.
We're in the money. We're in the money. We've got a lot of what it takes to get along.
This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. And here's an email from Dawn. She wonders, does Kevin recommend that people enroll in some type of identity theft protection service? If so, please recommend some reputable services or tell us where we can read reviews and find out about the best services and values for our money. What about that, Kevin?
Yeah, that's a good question, especially because there's a company out there called LifeLock, which does a lot of advertising for this kind of service. And if I'm going to read a review on these kind of services, I'm not doing the work on my own. One of my favorite sources is to go to Consumer Reports. And you can find them at consumerreports.org and lots of other information as well. And they generally have not been a big fan of LifeLock and other companies like it. They say, you know, that the services can often be done by yourself. Now, sometimes people say, that's fine, it can be done by yourself, but I don't feel like doing it. I'd rather pay somebody a little more money to have them do it. And maybe that's a case to look at a company like this. But in terms of identity theft, one of the best ways that you can protect yourself is, as we discussed earlier, is to freeze your credit report. And by freezing it, it means that companies that don't have a relationship with you already cannot access your credit report. So that means if someone gets a hold of your personal information, including your social security number, that person cannot go to another company and use the company and try to apply for a credit card, basically. And then when that company tries to access a credit bureau, they won't be able to get at it if you've frozen it already. Now, it means that you can, the companies you're already working with, say if you have a credit card account, they can get access to the information on your behalf. You don't have to worry about the relationship with them. And if you do apply for a loan or apply for a credit card or apply for any situation where an organization says, we need access to your credit bureau, report, then you have to go to the credit bureau and basically unfreeze it. And it costs you $10 to do that. And then once they've accessed the information on your behalf, then you have to freeze it again. It costs you $10 to freeze it again. But again, most people don't have to do this maybe once or twice a year. I'd be shocked if it were that frequently. And you might end up paying $20 or $40 a year versus the $50 a month or so that many of these identity theft protection companies claim to do on your behalf, but that's what they charge.
Thanks, John, for that email. Now to the phones. Gary in Sun Prairie is with us. Hello, Gary.
Kevin and Joan.
Joan?
How are you?
April Fool to you, George. Go ahead.
No, this is Gary in Sun Prairie. A few years back, my father passed away, and I was made trustee of a trust for my brother, and all the liquid assets are now spent. But I'd like to be removed as the trustee. Can you give me any input on how I should go about doing that?
Sure. Have you contacted the attorney yet who originally wrote the trust?
I have.
Okay, and what was the response you got?
He said we have to do a complete accounting of the trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically where he left it.
Okay, yeah, and that's generally the case. And did he actually give this response to you after reading the trust, or was this kind of his shoot from the hip response?
This was probably shoot from the hip because it was by email.
Okay, that's fine, and that's probably true. But actually, the language of the trust will actually supersede his or my shoot from the hip responses, and so that's what will dictate the terms. And if the trust was written correctly, there are already terms in place to say what has to be done to get off of this. And if and you're going to have to go through a lawyer to do it. It might cost between $500 to $1,000, depending on how complex it is whatsoever, but it's definitely something you want to do sooner rather than later so that you don't have anything that comes back to bite you down the road for what's going on within the trust right now, even though, as you say, there's nothing really left in it. It's just good to clean it up and close it out.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Gary. Thanks for the call. Mary in Pewaukee is with us now. Hello, Mary.
Well, hi, Veronica.
That's a good one, Mary.
Thank you. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Okay, I have a problem. I have a son that's at college, and he...
Yeah, I understand that problem. I've heard several people who have that problem. Oh, there's more? Okay, I'm sorry.
Okay, he went with another cable company because when he was trying to get AT&T to set up his service, something went wrong with it, and... His problem, well, what happened is my husband ended up returning the cable box for him, and we put a letter in it explaining that it was never used, that, you know, we went with another cable company. And now, well, they started sending him collection agency letters, or that they would turn him over to collection, and he just ignored them and never mm-hmm. told us about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so now he sends me a letter saying that he's been turned over to collection, and I need to know, does he have to pay this bill in order to protect his credit, or is there some way for us to fight this with the collection agency when he never used the service?
Hmm. I love the notion. I remember being of this age where you would get some bad news in the mail or something, and you thought if you just didn't do anything, it would just go away. Adulthood sadly clues you in that that's not the case, and this is actually a good lesson for him and relatively pain-free compared to what could happen down the road if he were to do this again. What's the dollar amount that the good people at the jilted cable company say that you owe?
$122.
All right. Here's what I'm going to say to you, and you're not going to like it. If it were me, I would grumble, and pay the $122 because between the amount of time and energy it's going to take to clean this up with the collections agency and with the cable company and the possibility that his credit is going to be dinged at a time when he may be needing it either to apply for an apartment, lease, to get a cell phone, to get a credit card, car loan, or worse yet, apply for a job at some point, will not be nearly worth or be worth much more than the $122 for it. So I would chalk it up to experience it. I would consider it a lesson learned, hopefully, for him that he should, first of all, open his mail right away, and second of all, that make sure that you understand the terms of an agreement and you get clearance from people when you say, I'm giving this back to you. Can I get some kind of receipt for it so that I don't have to pay it?
Okay, so I have one other question then for you on that. Even though he's paid, his credit is good in other areas with his rent that he's paying at his apartment and his cell phone, this one area would be enough to ding his credit?
It won't help. Anytime anything's turned over to a collection agency, what the credit bureaus typically assume is when that report goes on there and they see his credit score, they don't assume, well, this is an isolated problem and he's probably a good person and a reliable risk. They assume, well, if this is the problem we know about, there must be other problems out there that just haven't come to the front, and it's definitely not worth saving $122. I could see fighting it on principle, but I can pretty much guarantee your time, money, and energy will greatly exceed the $122.
Thanks for the call, Marion. Sorry about that. Here's an email from a listener, an anonymous listener, who says, I know you have discussed leasing a new car. Would you please discuss the pros and cons of using cash or check to pay for a new car outright? Assume that no stocks or CDs need to be sold to make the purchase. Would you advise change if one was buying a used car? Would you advise change? How about if you pay for a car with cash or take out a loan?
Wait, no, I like the idea of paying with change.
Yeah, what is that?
Bringing $38,000 in pennies in to pay for it. One,
good
two.
Idea.
Oh, shoot, I lost count.
Yeah,
I got to start over again. I think paying for cash can be a great idea, as long as you have a ton of cash on hand and you have no other need for it. One thing that I see sometimes with people is they feel really good about paying cash for a vehicle, but it exhausts almost all of their cash. So they not only don't have any money set aside to pay for any problems down the road with the car, but pay for other things as well. And if you're doing everything else, like all of your other debt is repaid, for instance, you know, high interest credit card debt, you're maxing out any retirement savings plan opportunities you have at work, and you don't have any other big expenses coming up, sure, I could see writing a check for it. But I would want you to at least have 6 to 12 months of living expenses set aside after the check is written for the car. Now, one thing people who are kind of in a precarious situation financially should look at for paying cash is to say, hey, you might make your problems worse by overspending on a new car. So as a rule of thumb, if you can pay cash for the car, you can afford it. But if you're in trouble already and you can't write a check for it, maybe you should look at a different way to pay for the vehicle, or if you're buying one at all.
Well, April Fools, I misread his email. The last line was, would your advice change if it were a used car versus a new car?
No, it would not change. Not change at all.
Good. Let's go to Steve in Eau Claire next. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Joan. Kevin, appreciate your program.
Now, is Cynthia Schuster, my on-air producer, telling you to call me Joan by any chance?
Never.
Steve, my name's Joy, but that's okay. Go ahead.
Joy. Sorry about that. Well, you know, I don't know a whole lot about finances and things like that, but I do enjoy listening to your program. Learned a lot. I just have a question about silver. I've got a bug in my ear last Christmas about getting my kids some gifts of silver. And just wondering, where's a good place to get silver? Does it come in different forms? What would be a good gift idea in light of silver? And I'm not thinking anything expensive, just an ounce or two or something like that.
It's a nice notion, and if it's just kind of a gesture rather than an actual investment, I wouldn't worry too much about, you know, paying a little bit more in fees than possible, because you're not looking to turn around and sell this right away. One thing that actually kind of can have some silver purchase, but also have a little bit more, let's say, romantic aspect to it, is to buy them a silver coin, and maybe one from, you know, your birth year if you're old enough, or another important year in history. And that way they can have some silver, but still have something that has some numismatic value or antique value or historical value. If you're going to buy silver outright, you can probably contact a dealer who can sell you the ingots. Well, keep in mind that the fees that you're going to pay, the lower dollar amount you invest, if you will, in silver, the higher percentage that the fees will take up of the purchase. So don't expect to make a whole lot of money on that if they turn around and flip it. And then finally, if you're going to just say, well, no, I want to buy this as an actual investment, and the fact that silver is going to go up in value, it might be a good idea to purchase it in paper form. There are several different mutual funds that invest just in, you know, silver metals, and they allegedly store the silver for you on your behalf, and then the price of the fund rises and falls fairly commensurately with the value of silver itself.
Thank you very much, Steve, for the call. You know, that would have been a pretty good April Fool's joke. My producers could have told every caller to call me a different name.
Oh, they would never do something like that.
Yes, they would. Well, I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. Kevin is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Here to answer your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. And it is time now for the Smart Assets segment of the show. We are talking today about ways to avoid being fooled financially. What are some of the things to watch out for in the investment sector, Kevin?
One of the top areas of complaints and questions we get here, but a lot of the regulators get as well, is over annuities. And these are products offered by insurance companies, generally through salespeople or sales agents. And there are two different kinds, generally variable annuities and fixed annuities. And they're not inherently evil. But because they generally offer higher commissions and therefore have higher expenses and are very difficult to understand, there's usually a 200 to 300 page prospectus that comes with these annuities. There is a lot of room for disappointment with investors and a lot of room for confusion for them as well.
Well, why don't we start with the variable version?
Okay, these would be generally mutual funds within an annuity, and the nice thing about it is the gains that you have are sheltered from taxation as long as they're held within an annuity. And there are some variable annuities that purport to offer you all the upside of a particular stock market type mutual fund, but a guarantee underneath. They say, well, there's a 6% guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit, and whether it's on the side of the salesperson or the side of the investor, sometimes that's confused by, and people think they're getting 6% a year in this plus all the upside, and it's definitely not true. What they do is they allow you to annuitize it at a rate as like you made 6% a year on the money. So it's only good if you're willing to pull the money out in little pieces over the rest of your life usually. And also for those services, you not only have to pay higher expenses in a variable annuity typically, but then there's an insurance premium for that kind of guarantee. And once you get all these fees and premiums paid into, your annual returns can be reduced by 3 to 4% of the value per year, meaning that if the raw mutual fund, let's say, within the account makes 10%, by the time you pay all the expenses associated with it, your return is reduced down to, say, 7 or even 6% whatsoever. And then if you don't like the annuity, many times there's no initial charge to get in, and sometimes people are fooled into thinking that they didn't pay any commission to get in. But there's a surrender charge, and the surrender charge usually starts out at somewhere around 6 to 7% and then declines over 7 or 8 years. So you could end up, even if you keep it in there 3 or 4 years, it might still cost you 3 or 4% of your money to pull it out. Basically, if you don't understand this and you don't trust the individual selling it to you, don't buy it. If you really want to be a part of the stock market and not have to worry so much about expenses and get better tax benefits, you may be better off with an index fund from a company like Vanguard.
Okay. What about fixed rate annuities?
We're hearing a lot more about these lately because a lot of people are searching around for safe investments and hopefully something that pays a little bit of return. But while these fixed rate annuities can be nice and they can be relatively safe, you're still better off going with an actual CD. A fixed rate annuity is really a loan to the insurance company, and you're highly likely to be paid off for that loan, but it still is a loan to the insurance company. If the investments they make on your behalf within that annuity don't pan out, you might not get all of your money back, and you might not get the rate of return you were promised. By going with a CD, you get FDIC insurance, which is government insurance, which is better than almost every insurance company, and there are less costs, and it's easier to get out of. There are no surrender charges. You usually only have to pay 6 to 12 months worth of interest, and right now there are three banks nationwide, Nationwide Bank, GE Capital, and CIT all offer 5-year CDs that pay around 2%. Typically, they have 6-month to 12-month penalties if you pull it out early, but again, that's a rate that most fixed rate annuities pay, but you're better off with the CD.
And just Speaking of insurance, we do get a lot of questions about life insurance. Is that a foolish investment?
As an investment, yes. Life insurance is very good tool to use if you are worried about the economic value of the loss of a person. I mean, that person passes away, and for whatever reason, it'll cost the survivors financially. And most people are sold the wrong kind of insurance. It's cash value life insurance, like universal or whole life, and that's usually too expensive, and there's not enough of a death benefit to make a difference in these people's lives, and it's especially not as good as an investment because the fees, again, can be so high. A much better way to go is to buy lots and lots of term life insurance, and you generally want to have, if you want to provide for survivors, you want to have enough term life insurance benefit so that you're paying for roughly 200 to 300 times the net monthly expenses of the survivors, meaning let's say there's a breadwinner out in the workforce and there's a stay-at-home parent and a couple kids. If they have $4,000 of expenses every single month, and they're relying on the breadwinner's income to cover those expenses, they might want to have 200 to 300 times that $4,000 amount, so $800,000 to $1.2 million of term life insurance on the breadwinner.
We have a question about insurance from John in Schofield. Hello, John.
Morning, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
This is really is a joke, isn't it?
What's that? I was wondering what Kevin thought about Survivors Universal Life Insurance. Just a couple of numbers. We have an annuity that's worth about $125,000, and about half of that would be subject to taxes. It's about 20% of our total assets, not counting our house and personal property, which is paid for. We do have long-term care that we've been paying for 6 or 8 years, I guess, and no other debt. And at the end, this was a 10-year term. After both my wife and me pass away, supposedly our heirs, our son and daughter, would get $270,000 tax-free. And I just wonder what Kevin thinks about that. And I would just mention we are sustaining members to public radio and public TV. But just a simple yes or no will do, Kevin.
Yes or no, then. Thank you, John, and thank you for your support of public radio. No, and thank you for support. I'm not fooling when I say that. And because you are members, I will actually give you the accurate information. Most other people, especially today, get the incorrect information, but I'll give you the accurate information.
I would just mention we have no other debt other than normal operating expenses, I guess.
Okay. Let me ask you a question. Was this an idea you came up with on your own, or did someone present it to you?
Well, we thought about it, but our financial advisor, I'll tell you, is with Edward Jones. I am pretty confident in him, and we have a pretty good relationship with him.
Sure.
Basically, it was something he recommended that we look into a little bit.
It's not the worst idea in the world. It's not as bad as some people might think it is, but the concern I have about this is that if you need the money after you've turned it over to this policy, for whatever reason, and you know, you sound like you're in decent shape, but you never know what's going to come up, you're going to find that the value that you moved from the annuity to the life insurance policy has been reduced, in some cases very substantially, because of the sales commissions on top of this. And sometimes I hear this as a good strategy, and it's one I respect. Other times I hear this because it sounds like the salesperson is actually looking for the new commission to make, because they're going to make a lot more, obviously, on this new policy and selling it to you than they would if they were to just keep the money in the actual annuity. And so I would be leery of it. Part of the problem with this is I bet you were given some kind of hypothetical demonstration that said, hey, if you just do this and then the money within the policy makes this, then your heirs will get this. Was it some conversation like that?
Yeah, give me a good example of how it would work out. It's hypothetical, yeah.
Sure, and that's important that you know that and that they reiterate that to you. Was there an interest rate, a hypothetical interest rate, John, that they used?
It gradually went down over a period of years. If the best thing would be if we would take it out and die tomorrow, boy.
Oh, that would be sweet. Yeah, you're right. You're right, because yeah, there might be more benefit for it. But if it's a declining benefit, as you're more likely to actually need it for it, I would be leery of it. I wouldn't be a big fan of doing this at this point in your life. And that's not to be completely against cash value life insurance. Many times business owners say, or people with an estate tax issue, buy cash value life insurance for a good reason, because they need it to be there. That it's permanent life insurance, that as long as they make the premium payments, or the premium payments are made, the policy will be in place for it, versus term insurance, which technically is just for a term. But based on what you told me, John, I'm not completely averse to the idea, but I would advise you to say no.
John, thank you for the call, and we wish you a very long and happy life. I'm Choi Cardine with Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. We will talk about some ways you can avoid being fooled when you're shopping and spending coming up next during On Your Money here on the Ideas Network.
My mama told me you better shop around. Oh, yeah, you better shop around.
This is an April Fool's edition of On Your Money, and we have some more information now on how you can avoid being fooled while spending money and shopping around. Kevin, let's start with extended warranties.
Yes, one of my favorite topics. I actually don't have a problem with extended warranties or with buying extended coverage. A lot of people get kind of torqued off about it because they say, well, geez, now here's an extra charge for it. But you have to remember, from, you know, if you assume the best intentions of the retailer and the manufacturer, what they're saying is they're allowing you to spend more money if that protection is worth it to you, and allowing people who it's not worth to not spend more money, just to save a little bit of it. Where I have a problem with it is where, you know, you're ringing it up and, you know, they ask you at Radio Shack if you want the coverage on your AAA batteries or whatever for an extra 8 cents or something. Those are big profit centers for the people who do sell them, and generally the coverage is not quite what you would expect it to be. First of all, the product probably already has a warranty. Might only be 90 days, might be 120 days, might even be a year, but check to see if the product already has its own manufacturer's warranty and what the terms are. Second, if you pay for this with a credit card, and the credit card may have coverage already, where they say if you buy this item, we'll double the manufacturer's warranty on it, or we'll extend it out beyond the original manufacturer's warranty. And if you pay the credit card off right away, you don't pay any interest costs, and so you get the coverage that way. And third, products today are very unlikely to fail, especially if they don't fail immediately. It just is, if it's not a piece of junk right out of the package, it's probably going to be okay. And so therefore, the hassle and expense of having a warranty on it is probably not going to be worth it anyway. And if it is some kind of technological piece of equipment, these things drop so quickly in value, you might be better off saying, well, I'm going to buy this, I'm not going to buy the warranty, and if it does break 6 months down the road, I'm just going to buy a used version of it on eBay or Craigslist or something, and you'll still have hopefully a newer product and without all the hassle of it. One exception is a lot of manufacturers offer refurb products, especially PCs and computer screens and televisions, where these are ones that have been sent back to the factory originally and they've been refurbished and at the factory. SquareTrade is a company that offers a warranty on many of these products, and it extends it out much longer than what the original manufacturer's warranty is on the refurb. And people give very good responses to SquareTrade, not only for the cost, but for the service afterwards.
Speaking of using a credit card, I use a credit card just about always. Is that foolish?
No, I don't think it's foolish at all, as long as you can, if you're doing it for an emergency, or you can afford to pay off the bill, or if you're comfortable paying the interest for it. It's especially a good idea to use a credit card if you are concerned about theft of that information and your funds, because a credit card is actually safer than a debit card. You get better protection from the crooks, from them stealing your data with a credit card than you do with a debit card for it. And, as we mentioned, from an unhappy purchase, if you buy something with a credit card, you now have an ally on your side who can hopefully freeze payment to the seller and say, look, these people bought this thing with their credit card, and we're not going to give payment to you because they've lodged a complaint with us. And until we resolve the complaint, we're not going to give you your money. So that gives you an advantage if you're dealing with a product or service that you're not happy with. Whereas with a debit card, generally the funds go directly into the seller's account, and it's very difficult to get that back out. But again, the interest cost of many credit cards can more than offset any benefits offered by paying for things with credit cards, so make sure if you do use it, you try to pay it off every single month.
So I shopped for a lime yesterday at the grocery store.
I did too. Despite the weather, I feel like April 1st is gin and tonic season, and I'm with you on that, sister.
Yeah. But the reason I bring this up is that it was like $1.29 or something like that for this tiny lime. Prices really are on the rise, especially for limes. How do we avoid being fooled when we're shopping for groceries?
Well, and that's going to happen. The drought in California, which for better or for worse is you know, the nation's fruit and vegetable basket when it comes to providing us with fresh produce, that's going to really hit in the next few weeks here, and it's probably going to go on all summer. So there's things I've heard, not only are limes $1.99 each and versus, you know, what, 39 cents a piece, mm-hmm. but also you may not be able to find artichokes and cauliflower and celery and several other vegetables that we're used to not only being able to get, but get very cheaply. So first of all, bring a calculator with you to the supermarket, because you may be fooled by something that appears to be on sale, but when you divide out the price by the unit, by whether it's weight or number of items in the particular package, you might find it's better off to go with one that's not on sale. When it comes to vegetables, you definitely want to start looking at buying frozen, not fresh, because the frozen one is much cheaper, usually 20 or 30 cents on the dollar compared to fresh. And if you're going to be cooking with it, you really won't notice a big difference for it if you buy it in the freezer versus if you buy it fresh. Try not to buy any water if you can help it. And by water, I mean the first items that you can buy concentrated, like orange juice. It's much less expensive to buy a can of frozen orange juice than it is to buy a big jug of orange juice, and then you just add your own water. But then again, try not to buy bottled water. Most tests show that bottled water has the equal quality of tap water, but it's 300 times more expensive than tap water. And then also, we have to find a place for those billions of plastic bottles we use every single year.
We have an email from Tony and Darlene, so both of them want to know, and they have two questions for you too, Kevin.
I guess that counts.
Freezing credit and credit cards for a married couple. Is it necessary to check the credit reports for both Social Security numbers? And when freezing your credit, is it necessary to pay the $10 fee for each credit reporting agency for both Social Security numbers? If so, would it cost $60 then to freeze your credit? Is that correct?
It can be. And yes, it is necessary. I like the fact that they are applying for loans together. They even have their own email account together, which I think is sweet. Yes, each individual is considered as an individual when it comes to Social Security numbers for credit reporting agencies, et cetera. Even if you're filing jointly, let's say, for a loan or a mortgage application, they're going to look at both credit histories. And so, therefore, you do want to treat, sadly, it's no comment on your marriage or your relationship, Tony and Darlene, but you do want to look at each report. And, yes, it will cost $60 to freeze it. Now, the good news is, if you do need to thaw it in the future, you can ask the inquisitor, what bureau are you going to check? And then you can contact that bureau directly and unfreeze the report just for that bureau. So it'll be $10 for each one of you, and then another $10 to freeze it again. And some lenders will say, look, I'm sorry you have to go through this. As part of this package, we'll subsidize the cost of freezing or thawing and then refreezing your credit report.
I'm Joy Cardine with Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. Our next caller is Cindy in Duluth. Hello, Cindy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Hello? Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I have a question that you actually already addressed, but it was regarding annuities for my mother-in-law. She was given some information by a financial advisor where she lives, and we asked that she send it to us so we could look it over. And as you said, there were all sorts of hidden fees in it. She doesn't really believe us, though, and we got her to not take that out. But she called us again and said she needs more money than her CD of 1% will pay her. She wants us to check out annuities. I checked it out again, and I saw that there's a hybrid annuity, but you said nothing really should be taken out with annuities. Is that still your philosophy?
It's not that no one should ever, or no one should not ever take one out. Is that right? But it's just that I'm glad that she, even though she might not be glad that you're on her side, I'm glad that you're on her side, because these things are complicated enough to look at if you're a financial advisor. much less if you are a person in your 50s or 60s, and even more so if you're, you know, the average person in their 70s or 80s. And I totally understand why she would say, look, I need more money than what the CD is providing. But she should understand that in return for trying to get that higher risk or that higher reward, she's taking on higher risk. And she needs to know that there's a decent chance that she might be able to get 2 or 3 or 4% or even 8% a year. But the higher that number goes, the more likely it is that she could also lose 5 or 10 or 15 or even 30% in a given year. And there really is no annuity out there or any other kind of product that can offer all the return on the upside and none of the potential loss on the downside. And so it's a very natural inclination for her to feel this way, and I understand it, but she has to be very careful about overreaching when trying to get a higher rate of return.
Right. So I was going to tell her to just take out a CD with, like you said, GE. They offer mm-hmm. a better rate. So I think I will just...
I'd really lean towards that. And if she says, you know what, I really want to do this and this sounds like a great deal, find out what the minimum investment is for it. And then she can put that dollar amount in it to start. And then if it works out really great and she loves it and grows comfortable with it, then she maybe might want to add more money to it down the road.
Good luck, Cindy. Thank you for the call. Nick in Green Bay is with us now. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Hi. My wife and I purchased a house last summer, and the bank that we go through, we also do our checking and savings, and they had a deal where the first year they would reduce the interest rate by 1%. And you keep hearing on the radio these other community credits where you roll everything over to them and they'll find a reduction in interest rates and save you so much money on that. And I'm wondering the benefits, whether or not that's feasible or not.
You mean rolling it over into like a credit union is what you're talking about?
Exactly. Moving all of our money, checking, savings, direct deposit, our mortgage, and mortgage is the only debt that we have, into a credit union from a big bank institution and trying to capitalize on what they say they can save us in interest rates and whatnot.
Yeah, generally, they probably cannot... in terms of the checking, et cetera, yeah, you might find a little bit of savings and some maybe more friendlier terms at the credit union than you're finding at the bank. Not always, but I usually you can. In terms of the mortgage, though, I would be very leery about redoing the mortgage with the credit union, because if you move it over to the credit union, they're probably going to have to start a whole new one for you, and unless they can offer you, you know, a much better rate or some kind of increase in the valuation of the home or more mortgage maybe than what you were allowed to get at the bank, I would not do that, because the fees between the closing costs, the new appraisal, whatever, will probably far exceed. It could be several thousand dollars, and it wouldn't surprise me. So I'd probably leave the mortgage where you have it. And I'm guessing, you know, that mortgage has probably been sold already from the bank that underwrote it originally, right?
That I'm not 100% sure.
Okay. Do you know
I haven't seen anything in writing saying that it has.
Okay. So you're still sending your mortgage payment to the place that gave you the first mortgage?
Correct.
Okay.
It's automatically withdrawn from our checking.
Okay. That might look like that. I'm guessing that it probably was packaged and moved on unless it was a rare case. Most mortgages today are not actually held by the original lending institution. But look into the credit union and say, here's our situation. And really, we get kind of thrown off track when it comes to things like financial institutions, where you know, people who will drive around trying to save 5 cents on gas or you know, try to buy a gallon of milk 50 cents cheaper here than somewhere else, will never look at their bank or their credit union for that matter and say, hey, I'm going to shop this around. One of two things is going to happen. I'm either going to find a better place for me. It's either higher service or lower cost, or hopefully both. Or I'm going to go back to the original and go, wow, you guys were giving me a really good deal after I shopped around for this. I found that you were still the best place for me. And that's hard to do sometimes. Times, but it's something I definitely recommend.
Barely time for the website of the week, Kevin.
Well, we barely have two of them. USA.gov's consumer website has a ton of information on ways to avoid fraud, and so does the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection in Wisconsin. We'll have links to both of those websites at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
Good stuff. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more, Kathleen.
Thanks a lot, Keith. Keith McKinley is with us every week at this time with information and advice on your money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.